regulations, and safeguards.
Head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization added that Iran has now gained a foothold in the sector. He said not only will he be attending the upcoming IAEA General Conference in Vienna, but Iran will be holding its first exhibition there as well.
The production of cesium-137 is the result of 6 months of hard work. But Iran's Atomic Energy Organization says it is not stopping there. And very soon we will be hearing more news about the production of more radioisotopes, particularly from nuclear waste. Gisumi Shahmari, Tehran.
Al-Bayouk family, who lives in one of the most marginalized areas in southern Gaza Strip, Qizan Rishwan, is the main supporter of the talented son Mohammed as he's pursuing his dream. The 13-year-old boy was elected to participate in the football contest in Tunisia, but his permit to leave the besieged Gaza Strip was denied by the Israeli authorities. But when he managed to leave the region and participated in the tournament, Mohammed did his best for his country.
My son, along with his teammates from the besieged Gaza Strip, got the chance to compete in the Norway Cup finals against four countries with 43 teams. I knew that my son is talented, but I just was able to support him with what was available due to the economic situation in the besieged Gaza Strip. It wasn't easy for me as a father of four to provide food and equipment needed to improve his physical condition and skills. Sometimes I couldn't buy him football shoes due to high prices, so he had to play with low-quality second-hand ones or to borrow from our friends and neighbors.
It was Friday noon and the whole family gathered to watch the match. I was praying for him. It was a tough match, especially in the extra time, and it was my son who scored the golden goal that qualified them for the finals. I was happy for him that he managed to leave Gaza to participate in the Norway Cup, but at the same time, I was concerned for his safety. But thankfully, they came back with the cup, and they raised the Palestinian flag in the world.
The passion for playing football has grown fast, and 2 years ago, he had the chance to sharpen his skills when he joined the Youth Stars Center, where he used to train with low-quality equipment.
I love football so much. Despite the cancelling of our trip to Tunisia by the Israeli occupation, I made it up to Norway and won the cup, where I scored 5 goals. I wish we had big stadiums like those I played there. Here, I play at the pitches with poor quality. I wish I could join Real Madrid club one day and play like Luka Modric. I wish I could visit Portugal, Spain, France and Denmark. I've shown the whole world that even if we suffer from the Israeli occupation in the besieged Gaza Strip and don't have the chance like other children around the world and don't enjoy our full rights, despite all that, we're resilient and we try our best.
Israel always interferes in the Palestinian sports affairs. It annoys entry of equipment needed for different sports. Palestinian athletes face arrest and travel bans when they have to participate in a tournament. Israeli suffocating blockade is destroying sports facilities in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have demonstrated a strong determination to stand up against occupation, blockade, and poverty. The young Palestinians have understood that this is their only hope to gain international support.
Despite the overwhelming odds that Palestinians endure in the Gaza Strip, a glimpse of hope shines through the most impoverished areas in defiance, telling the whole world that there is on this land whatever makes life worth living. Ula Al-Asib, Gaza.
Cancer patients in Gaza staged a sit-in protest to condemn the Israeli blockade that has taken its toll on their lives. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before they even can access treatment. Hospitals in Gaza grapple with a severe shortage of medicines, particularly those vital for cancer patients. The journey to receive crucial life-saving medical care is fraught with numerous obstacles for cancer patients in Gaza. Israeli restrictions on freedom of movement have prevented Palestinian patients with serious illnesses from seeking urgent medical treatment beyond the blockaded territory.
Lack of medical equipment and Israeli obstacles are hurting cancer patients. Doctors here are tirelessly working to help us, but the resources are limited. I have throat cancer, and my treatment is not always available in Gaza. I call on all the people around the world to help alleviate our suffering.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer from acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment, experiencing a staggering 60% deficit rate. Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to deteriorate further. Israeli authorities also impose a ban on the entry of medical devices and equipment into the Gaza Strip, further weakening the provision of health services to cancer patients.
The worst obstacle facing us is the lack of medicines, especially chemotherapy and radiation therapy supplies for cancer patients. The number of cancer patients in Gaza is very high, and with the current shortages, we can't treat all of them.
The health sector has been grappling with critical shortage of medicines and medical equipment due to the Israeli blockade in place since 2007.
Health officials are calling on the international community to help end the shortage of medicines in the besieged Gaza Strip and save the lives of Palestinian patients. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
For the first time in United States history, a former president now has a mugshot. Donald Trump has been arrested in Georgia and is being prosecuted under racketeering charges for allegedly trying to subvert the state's 2020 presidential election votes. 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still say President Joe Biden's election was not legitimate.
You should be able to challenge an election. I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election. And I should have every right to do that. As you know, you have many people that you've been watching over the years do the same thing, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Stacey Abrams or many others.
It's the fourth arrest for Trump in 5 months, even as Trump is running neck and neck with Biden in 2024 election polls. That has many accusing the ruling Democrats of election interference and of weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents, and of dangerously dividing the country.
Because it was dragged on for so many years, and it was really made into a theater, and Donald Trump was able to use this, ironically, to build his brand, to build this this lie that the election was stolen, and really, really just brainwashed millions of people, you know, into continuing to support him. I think it really spells disaster for the unity of the ruling class.
Trump's popularity among Republicans has soared since the first indictment, and he seems certain to be their candidate next year. Polls show the nation is almost perfectly split regarding Trump's 4 court cases and 91 felony charges. While a part of the United States has become galvanized both for and against Trump, for decades the United States has been defined by political apathy, low voter turnout rates, and disinterest in Washington politics seen as so corrupt it's routinely referred to as the swamp.
It seems like a lot of work, and typically I feel like people that high up don't really ever get convicted of anything, so might be a lot of time and money and effort going towards nothing at the end, so I don't know.
The 2024 presidential campaign began this week with the first Republican Party primary debate, but the focus was on Donald Trump, and the focus will likely remain on Trump for at least the next 15 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU statistical agency Eurostat's latest report on business registrations and bankruptcies leaves little room for interpretation. Small and medium businesses across the old continent are struggling amid the unprecedented challenges posed by some global events such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the energy crisis, high levels of inflation and high interest rates. Bankruptcy declarations in the European Union reached the highest level since 2015 in the second quarter of this year. The number of closures in the April-June period was 8% higher than the previous quarter, marking a sixth consecutive increase. Hungary, Latvia, and Estonia have recorded the highest number of enterprises declaring bankrupt in 2023.
It is important to stress that Eastern European countries benefited enormously from delocalization over the past two decades.
Today, the enduring effects of the many crises are also evident on the Eastern Europe.
A sharp increase in the number of bankruptcy declarations has been recorded in the accommodation and food services sectors across the whole old continent. Registrations of new businesses are declining. The clock is ticking in Italy as well. The Confederation of Italian Enterprises, Confindustria, has reported that about 120,000 companies in Italy are facing bankruptcy and as many as 370,000 jobs are at stake. Soaring gas and energy prices, high inflation and the rising cost of borrowing money have worsened an already difficult situation. For over 15 years, the exit rate of companies in the country has been much higher than the entry rate. According to the authoritative agency CERVED, hundreds of thousands of companies have closed and millions of jobs have gone wasted since 2008. CERVED estimates that about 3 million workers risk losing their jobs in the coming months.
In his maiden speech to the Upper House in 2021, former Prime Minister Mario Draghi pointed out that a new selective industrial policy discussed by the members of the G30 was needed to limit the rising number of the so-called zombie companies, those firms unable to pay their long-term debts. It goes without saying that Italy's workers and small and medium-sized enterprises, which account for the vast majority of Italian firms, are bearing the brunt of this policy.
L'economia funzionano come i vasi comunicanti.
Our Western economic systems are connected like communicating vessels. In my view, things will get worse as the vessels are connected too tightly.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine and the curtailment of Russian pipeline gas supplies to Europe, companies in energy-intensive sectors have been the most affected. Max Civili, Rome.
South Korea kicked off yet another round of large-scale military exercises with the U.S. by conducting Air Force drills early this week. South Korea says the joint drills are based on an all-out war scenario and will involve field training and command post exercises and address cyber threats and terrorism. The drills follow the recently concluded trilateral summit with Japan at Camp David, where President Biden warned the DPRK and other countries.
We're doubling down on information sharing, including on the DPRK's missile launches and cyber activities, strengthening our ballistic missile defense cooperation. And critically, we've all committed to swiftly consult with each other in response to threats to any one of our countries from whatever source it occurs.
The joint U.S.-South Korea drills under President Yoon actually lead to a decline in national security, say some NGO leaders.
If the large-scale military exercises of South Korea and the U.S. continue, North Korea will respond with provocations. And then strategic assets such as fighter bombers of the U.S. forces will be engaged, and the vicious cycle carries on. At this rate, these military exercises will expand further and become regular. So, of course, the tension on the Korean Peninsula will increase.
The DPRK has indicated it will launch a satellite in the coming days as it seeks to bolster its surveillance activities.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has reversed course in much of the country's foreign policy. Engagement with the DPRK has been replaced with confrontation. And while U.S. President Biden praises President Yoon for his political courage, many South Koreans oppose his policies.
Trilateral cooperation with Japan is particularly touchy in South Korea for historical reasons, and opposition to the Fukushima nuclear contaminated water release further damaged sentiment toward Japan. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Change in the world can come if nations function on the principle of mutual cooperation and respect. But the imperative is to break free from the status quo, and BRICS leaders have a number of proposals they want implemented to realize this. Among the most urgent being accelerating de-dollarization, establishing a common currency, and countering Western-imposed sanctions.
For me,
Through the new development bank, we can offer our own alternatives for the adequate financing that will attend to the needs of the Global South. Through the help of my sister Dilma Rousseff, the bank will manage to face the challenges, the creation of a common vetted unit for our trade transactions and investments for BRICS countries will increase payment options and reduce our vulnerabilities.
With an increasing number of countries wanting to join BRICS, the group presents prospects of prosperity, cooperation and development. As the sessions were underway here, India successfully landed its Chandrayaan 3 mission on the moon. And this is the type of expertise and know-how that can hopefully be shared through a mechanism such as BRICS.
Through initiatives such as the BRICS satellite constellation, the vaccine R&D center, mutual recognition of pharma products, we are bringing about positive changes in the lives of ordinary citizens in BRICS countries. Through initiatives such as the Youth Summit, BRICS Games, the Think Tanks Council, we are strengthening people-to-people ties in all countries.
The West's reliance on sanctions has inadvertently strengthened those it wanted to isolate. Russia highlighted how sanctions have hampered the international economic system. And even with traditional allies of the United States, such as Saudi Arabia, knocking at BRICS' door, change looks very much possible. BRICS now stands on the threshold of becoming a far more influential body, one which will shape a new world order and present a true challenge to the West's stranglehold. The final day of deliberations, which will look at expansion, will decide its future. Hassan Siriyap, Santon.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Business bankruptcies in the EU have surged to their highest levels since the year 2015. Why is the EU experiencing such a high rate of business bankruptcies? It is reported that this is fueled by the trouble in the food and accommodation sector. Why those two sectors? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the leading factors which are making businesses fail at such an alarming rate, whether the government can help them or not, and whether it can actually sustain this rate, how much this actually affects Europeans, and what the state of the European economy is as a whole anyways. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. John Edmonds, economist, academic, and author, joins us from Wellesley, Mass. Also joining us is Clive Menzies, researcher and commentator, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. John Edmonds, first over to you. Look at record business bankruptcies in the EU. According to the stats, the highest levels since the year 2015. So the basic question is, what do you think are the leading causes for this?
Leading causes would be higher costs, particularly energy, but also food. And both of those I would lay at the doorstep of Vladimir Putin. The food part, the cost increase wouldn't be so direct, but that comes through restriction in the availability of grain to the world market, which causes knock-on effects to the price of corn and other grains, and then works its way up the processing chain to the point where the costs for a restaurant would have gone up more than what they can charge for the meals. They can't charge more for the meals because their household income in the areas where they operate hasn't gone up as much. So their margins, which were never very high in the first place, have gotten squeezed, and a lot of them just really cannot continue. So I think that's really a very revealing indicator about the condition of the European economy, because you see that although the broad metrics are not so bad, at the granular level, at the level of individual households, there are quite a few of them that are hurting quite badly.
All right. Taking a look at what's leading the pack here in terms of the increase of bankruptcies, let's see. We have food service bankruptcies, which is a 24% increase from the previous reading. And we also have accommodations, which I'm guessing would obviously be hotels, motels, resorts, et cetera. Why do you think those two, Clive Menzies, are leading the pack?
Well, I think I would first take issue with the causes, the fundamental cause. This has been an economic collapse that has been unfolding since 2008, accelerated with the COVID psyop, where huge swathes of the economy were closed down across Europe and the Western world. And when it comes to And that affected primarily the small to medium-sized businesses and the large players, particularly companies like Amazon, Google, etc., were the beneficiaries of that economic sabotage, if you like. When it comes to Ukraine and the sanctions, that was basically the Western economies, and particularly the US, putting pressure on Europe to shoot itself in the foot by basically sanctioning Russia for a war that started in 2014, where Russia was trying to protect the West, the Russian speakers in the east of the country. So essentially, this is an economic crisis, and these are symptoms of what is unfolding, and it's undoubtedly going to get worse. And it's been compounded by the green agenda, which again has no scientific basis, where we are, if you like, penalizing ourselves through denying ourselves access to fossil fuels. Obviously, the sanctions have also had their effect, although there is a degree of sanctions busting going on. So effectively, there are many factors that come into play, but they're mainly driven by policy. It's driven by lunacy, in effect, economic lunacy.
Okay.
And Europe is the major victim of this because they've been pressured into basically withdrawing from one of their major economic partners.
And that would be?
Russia.
Okay. Let's break down the timeline here from 2008 up to now. Taking a look at 2008, John Edmonds, our guest there, says that from the time the financial crisis gripped Europe and the downfall that Europe experienced then, that it never really recuperated from that. Do you agree?
It wouldn't have recuperated, and I entirely agree on the subject of the COVID, because a lot of businesses have high fixed cost, and if they're not getting any customers, then they gradually deplete their financial resources, and then when the COVID restrictions come off, they find that the rebound in their revenues was not enough, so then they throw in the towel. But I would also entirely agree that Europe has been in the squeeze in between the U.S. Pressuring Russia and Russia getting pressured from all sorts of unexpected pressures. So if you're in business, you're always trying to forecast the future, and whatever your forecast was, it looks pretty inaccurate now. So there would also have to be a discouragement factor among small business owners. A lot of small business owners really don't have much in the way of reserves or alternate employment, but they end up going and working for somebody else. I see that in the restaurants around where I live, that half of them failed and then some of them came back, but some of them came back under another heading or under another legal ownership. But then you go in there and it's some of the same people, but some of the people are different. So it's a very gig economy type of sector, no stability, and so a very bad time to take a risk with starting something new. And that also affects the statistics. So you have more and more businesses failing and not a corresponding number springing up from initiative and entrepreneurship. I think that's definitely affecting the state of mind of Europeans who, with reason, feel quite discouraged about economic prospects.
All right. We're going to expand on some of the points you made there. I'm trying to draw a timeline here and to see, based on this information that I'm going to provide you, Clive Menzies, why Europe has experienced what it has. Perhaps you can help us out here. So you have the financial crisis, as you mentioned, and Europe didn't fully recover from that. And you had in between 2008 and 2012, I believe, somewhere in the middle there, 2010, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, where you had the European Central Bank acting to try to cushion what Europe was feeling at the time. And it provided cheap loans of up to 1 trillion euros, okay? So you have that happening in terms of the, I don't know what you want to call it. You want to call it QE, you want to call it money printing, you want to call it stimulus, whatever name you want to give it. You had also the same thing happened now, where you had, when you fast forward it to the year 2020, the largest stimulus package ever was introduced by the EU, 2.018 trillion euros. To help rebuild what they call the post-COVID-19 Europe, which goes into the green configuration that you talked about, which you said is a hoax in a sense. What happened to all this money? Why did this not help Europe?
Well, there has been a huge amount of fraud and embezzlement, particularly in relation to the green agenda, the COVID agenda, PPE, Ukraine, money going missing, weapons going on the black market. But essentially what you've described in terms of a timeline is a progressive expansion of the money supply way beyond the productive capacity or need of the economy. And what happens in these circumstances, as in the Weimar Republic in Germany, as in France in 1720, eventually confidence in money is lost and the whole system collapses. So in terms of a timeline, we're on a trajectory that has been predictable for a long time. And if it was bad enough, the onset of the COVID, what I call a psychological operation, because there are many complexities to that, which we won't go into now. But basically, people were terrified into basically withdrawing from economic activity. It is now proved to be totally unjustified, as many of us were saying at the time. And Big Pharma has been the beneficiary in rolling out huge programs of drug manufacture being authorized without proper testing. People are dying and suffering ill effects. So there is a whole range of ills that come out of this trajectory. And the Ukraine, if you like, is the ice, because the amounts of money that are just being thrown at a war, which is affecting Russia. This has nothing to do with Russia's ambition to expand, but to protect its borders and protect the Russian speakers in the East. And this war could have stopped within months had NATO and all of its cheerleaders not continuously pressured Europe and the Ukrainians, the poor Ukrainians, the sort of cannon fodder in all this, to keep fighting. Sure. Fighting a war will not be won. They're being thrown into the meat grinder. We're now seeing organ trafficking that is sort of becoming more visible from this war, human trafficking. There are so many ills that are coming out of these policies, but they're all part of the same program, which is effectively a trajectory towards population reduction, total control of the human race through bogus climate policies to restrict movement, to use electric cars, which make no environmental or economic sense. You know, there's a ship somewhere burning with something like 3,000 vehicles at the moment because of batteries exploding or combusting. There are just so many ills that have been committed over the since 2008, whereas we should have had a system reset, okay, and a total rethink of the way we operate.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, John Edmonds, I'm going to address the same question to you, trying to figure out where this money went. I mean, the most recent one being what I just mentioned, which is called the biggest, what they call relief in the form of a stimulus of 2.018 trillion euros, of which they have this thing called the Recovery and Resilience Facility Fund of a total of 723.8 billion euros. Allocated to that, which is in the form of loans, et cetera. I mean, at least the $1.2 trillion back in 2010 maybe cushioned the blow somewhat, and the European economies were teetering on a positive GDP growth. But now, it didn't even take more than 2 years from when this was approved. Were you looking at what the topic of our program is, the EU experiencing such a high rate of business bankruptcies? Again, the question, where is the money going?
Well, anytime there's a fiscal stimulus, and we've had those on both sides of the pond, very large numbers.
But this isn't a stimulus. This is This is what they call, let me be more direct or more clear about what they're calling this, because I have it down. Yeah, I'm sorry, I take that back. They do call it a stimulus package. But when you take a look at it, it's not stimulus, they're loans, and then the other components to it are allocated towards the green energy scheme, or hoax, as some may call it. So maybe we'll get into that with Clive. Go ahead. I'm sorry about that.
Well, no, I think I'm going to say the energy situation in Europe is extremely complicated, and I do not profess to have all the answers. The real poster boy for getting everything wrong is England and to some extent Scotland and Wales. I don't know about them, but they have their electric bills at the retail level. I mean, a typical household had their electric bill go up by 3 or 4 times in a year, and there's your money that you would have spent at the restaurant or on a vacation. So meanwhile, the vacation hotel that you would have gone to is sitting there with their fixed costs, and you didn't show up because you gave all your money to the electric company. And so the hotel goes bankrupt, and it's a bad show all around. So consequently, the Europeans have good reason to be very dissatisfied with the remedies that they have seen. But I'm not going to defend any government, except to say that they always do something because they have to do something. And then whatever they do is always sloppy and larded up with all sorts of things that maybe shouldn't have been in there and benefiting people that didn't really need the help.
Yeah, I can never understand that, though, why that is. When you're spending the money, it should go to the people, because at the end, wouldn't the people make out in terms of their livelihoods, and then the government also in terms of maybe taxes? But maybe that's a whole other program. So, Clive Mencius,
I would direct subsidies to the cell phone addresses of people and give them electronic money, which is done in Africa. You can move money electronically from one cell phone to another, and in parts of Africa, that works a whole lot better than the conventional financial system. And you can also then target it, and you can be much, much more successful in giving it to the people who are actually supposed to be benefiting from it.
All right.
But they don't do
so
that.
We're at the halfway point here, so let's give the next half of the program, if we can, Clive Mencius, as to where Europe stands and its economy. I mean, what are we looking at in terms of the we don't have enough time to go through the respective economies of each EU country, but when you have the economic powerhouse of Europe, Germany, being described as dragging down the European economy, there's something wrong with the economy in Europe. What is leading that?
If I may, I'd just like to address the point about where all the trillions went.
Sure.
The person who coined the term quantitative easing is German by birth, Richard Werner. And he was in Japan when the Ministry of Finance was using its guidance window to restructure the Japanese economy. So it was effectively the central bank that restructured the Japanese economy. And Richard's solution proposal of quantitative easing was exactly what your other guest proposed, which is basically, if you want to stimulate economic activity, then you give the money to the consumers because they make the best choices. But what we've seen progressively over the last 14 years or more is money being given to prop up bankrupt banks, and money is basically driving this. So in terms of where we're going from here...
Okay, just a quick second, though. When you say that, so the money goes to the banks, what goes wrong there? The banks should give it to the people, right, so they could make money off the interest. But something happens... Where I think, from what you implied, that maybe it's not enough money is not going to the end user, the consumer, to use it and have it pumped into the economic cycle.
Well, it's quite complex, but essentially, our money system is a wealth transfer mechanism, which basically transfers money from those who need it most to those who need it least. And we can't really get into that in any great depth. But in essence, there has been economic activity as a result of the money, because the way the money is created is through debt. And what is notable in the figures that you provided at the beginning of this program is construction industry is still buoyant. It is only a matter of time before that suffers too, because this Ponzi scheme is going to collapse. But huge amounts of debt have been created, because the way you create money is through loans. yes, quantitative easing is buying bad debt off the commercial banks to enable them to lend more. But in essence, the whole thing is based on debt. And historically, throughout the centuries, the way that the system works, you have to have a reset. And we didn't have a reset in 2008. So to get back to the question you asked me, where do we go from here? If we carry on the way we are, then things are going to collapse. But fortunately, there are many factors coming into play to actually create a different type of system, which is not based on money. Now, at the moment, big data is controlled by those who control money. But if we open source big data, then you don't need money, because essentially the reason money was adopted was because within a family or community or a tribe, you had all the data at your fingertips about the sustainability requirements, the capacities, the needs, and the wisdom and the skills within the community. Once you went outside the community, you didn't have that knowledge, and there was no technology to provide that knowledge, unlike today. So money was adopted as a simple methodology. So rather than having to have all that data of, say, sustainability requirements, you actually had a medium of exchange that everybody trusted. Obviously, if you overinflate the money supply, they cease to trust it. So where we're at now is that increasingly at grassroots level, totally unseen by economic commentators and the media, is that more and more people are reverting to their communities and building their own solutions for health, for food, for information, looking at the way the law works in their country, and actually becoming much more self-reliant within communities, and those communities are beginning to connect. And there's copious evidence that self-organization is far more efficient than command and control. But I don't want to monopolize your segment. Well,
John Edmonds, go ahead.
Let me add to that. Decentralized platforms that are not controlled by any government, but instead exist only in the cloud, and those are sort of like clubs where members of the club can trade among themselves using a token which they create and which they manage. So what we're getting is we're getting parallel financial systems and parallel monetary systems, and I can certainly see that trend. What I don't see is how that would get spread to the people who would be able to benefit from it more directly. I think the cooperative community model that Clive was talking about is also quite relevant here, and I believe we would see it, but the data really focus too much on macro indicators and not enough on what's happening at the level of individual people and going more granular. We do not need to use aggregates anymore. We have enough data so we can actually figure out the condition of pretty much every person and what that person needs and see if somehow there's a way that society could provide that instead of just throwing another bucket of money at something and hoping that some of it splashes to the areas that are needed.
All right. You talk about, Clive, whether we've hit the bottom or not. I think if that's what you said, I think we're on our way. I mean, let's take a look at an example. I'm just looking at the Spain as an example, where the food inflation has topped 30%. Overall prices more than doubled. This is the fourth largest economy in the EU, surging by 54.4% over the past two decades. And food prices alone to have surged 79.3% over the same period that it mentioned in the case of Spain. How about in the UK? When you look at the food prices, I don't know what the exact rate is, but I believe it's around 20% or more. And if you compare that, for example, to the salaries that people make, I think in the past 10 or 15 years, it has been very minimal in terms of the increases. Are we past the point where people are, we'll see it, don't we, when people are coming out to the streets time and again protesting? At what stage are we at right now?
Well, I would say that in systemic terms, structural terms, the tide turned in 2022, that actually this system is collapsing and something else is taking its place. And one can feel the rising energy at grassroots level. Certainly in my local community, and I know of other communities across the UK and further afield. I think it's I think what we're essentially talking about is everyone relies on regulation these days. And regulation is basically long ago, almost from inception, is captured by the big players. So the structure is represented by the big players, and they are playing a rear guard action. They're getting more and more desperate, and the criminality within the system becomes ever more visible. But in terms of figures like inflation, I mean, inflation has been understated for at least the last decade, if not much longer. And I think your other guests talking about how looking at averages is pointless because there's such a sort of asymmetric power. So
before you continue, Clive, we're just fresh out of time. I'm so sorry, but thank you very much for your input, Clive Menzies, researcher and commentator from London. John Edmonds, a pleasure, economist, academic, and author from Wellesley, Mass. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak faces a fresh conflict of interest row over trade talks between London and New Delhi. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer has covered this story. With a general election not far away and the economy still struggling, Rishi Sunak is on the hunt for good news. Next month, he will be in New Delhi, India for the G20 summit, a visit that will be unusually rich with picture opportunities and chances to strike deals. Sunak's parents are of Indian Punjabi descent, and his wife, Akshata Murthy, is a hugely wealthy Indian businesswoman, fashion designer and venture capitalist. In many ways, it will be a homecoming for the first Asian couple ever to occupy No. 10 Downing Street. Sunak's business and trade secretary, Kemi Badenoch, has been in India over the past few days, laying the ground for a string of announcements with her G20 counterparts. Inevitably, much of the talk in the United Kingdom and Indian diplomatic, business and trade circles has been about the possibility of a post-Brexit trade deal between the United Kingdom and India. The two governments had hoped to conclude one last autumn, but negotiations have dragged on. Agreement between the world's fifth and sixth biggest economies, India and the UK respectively, to reduce tariffs on UK exports such as cars, and increase still further access for Indian workers to the United Kingdom would be a big deal for Prime Minister Sunak. But there are issues worrying Downing Street. India already tops the list of nations sending citizens to the United Kingdom. Between June of last year and June of this year, the number of Indian healthcare workers entering the United Kingdom leapt by 81%. From 18,570 to 33,669. Indians also topped other categories. While Brexiters in Sunak's party desperately want evidence that global Britain is real, they may not be thrilled to see that the flip side of liberated post-European Union trading arrangements means replacing EU workers with others from further afield. There is, though, another fear nagging away inside No. 10 and the Foreign Office. In return for lowering tariffs on British exports to Indian markets, New Delhi is asking for more visas for skilled workers such as IT professionals who work for Indian technology companies that have invested in Britain. India also wants improved access for young Indians to the United Kingdom. One of the main companies with an interest in securing more temporary visas to the United Kingdom is Infosys, the huge global leader in digital services and consulting co-founded by Akshata Murthy's father, N.R. Narayana Murthy. Although Akshata has only a 0.93% holding in the company, it's still worth £481 million and accounted for the vast majority of the Sunak family's wealth when the Sunday Times published its 2023 Rich List in May. Shivendra Singh, Vice President and Head of Global Trade at NASSCOM, the IT industry body, said new age technologies such as generative artificial intelligence, blockchain and machine learning have widened the demand-supply gap. We want to make it easier for IT workers to go to Britain to fill the gap on projects and then come back. They will go and return. This does not affect net migration at all. Infosys applied for 2,500 visas for the UK in 2019, primarily so that it could bring its staff to work on large outsourced IT contracts in the country. Being such a large enterprise, the company has the ear of the Indian government. The problem for Prime Minister Sunak is that a UK-India trade deal, if struck, is likely to be of considerable financial benefit to the company in which his own wife already has a very large financial stake. Questions about a conflict of interest are already being asked. What should the Sunaks do? That is what Number 10 has worried about for some time, according to one source aware of thinking at the top of government on this issue. There's a lot of concern about perception and what it would look like to people, a worry that one day someone will eventually join the dots. The Indian website The Wire has also covered the same story. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak may be facing more troubles over his wife's connection with IT giant Infosys, with calls for transparency over his interests as the free trade deal with India looks at increasing visas for Indian workers, according to the British newspaper The Observer, reporting on Saturday, 26th of August. Rishi Sunak faces a new conflict of interest row before a G20 summit in New Delhi next month, over claims that his family could stand to benefit financially from a post-Brexit trade deal that he's negotiating with India. Lawmakers and trade experts say there are concerns at the highest levels of government over potential transparency issues relating to his wife, Akshata Murthy's shareholding in Infosys. Akshata Murthy is the daughter of one of Infosys's founders, Narayana Murthy. The opposition head of the Parliamentary Select Committee on Business and Trade, Darren Jones, told The Observer that it was important for the Prime Minister to declare his interests. Darren Jones said, "I expect him to do so in respect of the India trade deal as well." The Shadow Trade Secretary, Nick Thomas Simons, said his party backed the trade deal with India, so it is important that Prime Minister Sunak is transparent about any relevant business links and his personal role in negotiations. In a statement to The Observer, a British government spokesperson said that the Prime Minister was pursuing a trade deal with India in the best interests of the United Kingdom. The Prime Minister's interests have been declared in accordance with the normal processes. The latest accusation follows last week's announcement that the British Parliament's standards watchdog had concluded that Sunak had breached the code of conduct, albeit unintentionally. He was admonished for failing to properly declare his wife's shareholdings in a childcare company that stood to benefit from new government policies. Akshata Murthy was at the centre of another controversy last year due to her non-domicile status in Britain, which excludes her from paying British taxes on overseas income. She subsequently consented to pay taxes on her foreign earnings going forward. The British Prime Minister will be travelling to New Delhi to attend the G20 summit next month, where he is expected to discuss the free trade deal talks in a bilateral meeting with the host, Prime Minister Narendra Modi. The aftermath of Brexit prompted Britain to pursue new global trade relationships, and a significant focus was directed towards forging a comprehensive trade pact with India. A crucial requirement put forth by India during the negotiations for a free trade agreement is the expansion of visas granted to its workforce in sectors like information technology and artificial intelligence.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.